Good morning and welcome to our WAMC roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue along with the incredible WAMC president, CEO, Dr. Alan Charter.
Whatever.
With the incredible Times Union Associate Editor, Mike Spain.
Well, thank you.
Say I missed you all. And the incredible University of Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter, Rosemary Armeo. Good morning, all. How are you?
Incredible.
Great.
Yes, how could we be anything else?
Yeah, whatever. Okay, so let's talk about the news of the day. We always welcome your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or our Facebook page, or you can tweet us as well. It's at WAMC Roundtable, at WAMC Roundtable, and you can join in with us as we talk about the issues of the day. So let us begin with, it was the story certainly that dominated the news yesterday, a tragic story out of Washington, D.C., and the D.C. Navy Yard, and that is the shooting. And I guess we're still getting to the bottom of this and figuring out what happened, and we're in one of those periods where there are certainly a lot more questions than there are answers. I think that's safe to say.
That's true. My biggest question is, what happened to the other two suspects they thought they saw on the tapes? Do you remember that?
Yes.
Right. They came out fairly soon, well, yesterday afternoon, early evening, and said that they were confident that that was not an issue any longer. So, you know, they were probably just misled by something somebody saw.
We've all covered breaking news, so we know how that can happen. And yet I found myself thinking of the other suspects who sort of disappeared after the bombing
Boston.
in Oklahoma City. Do you remember that?
Yeah.
When they didn't act alone.
So. Well, even the Boston massacre, immediate aftermath, there was all kinds of bad information coming out and being repeated. But it seems like the puzzle today is this kind of erratic behavior predictable? Can you track it? Would any of the laws that people are fighting so hard for and against to have background checks before people can purchase guns, would have that even been a factor in this case? And then I guess that is the discussion,
sadly. The case has left tons of questions. Number one is, why did he do this?
Right, the motive.
The motive seems very elusive. There's no note. There's no hints from his friends. It's very odd.
It is. Navy officials said the gunman, Aaron Alexis, 34 years old, who'd been working for a military subcontractor, was given a general discharge from the military in 2011 after exhibiting a pattern of misbehavior, which officials have declined to detail. Mr. Alexis had been arrested at least twice before for weapons violations, and a family member, according to a 2004 Seattle police report, said he had anger management issues.
Reports today said he also had secret clearance, classification clearance.
Yes.
And that his latest employer, I don't know, I'd like that.
How do you get that? I mean, I when you live in the capital region, there's a lot of people with that clearance because they work on government contracts, perhaps at the Knowles Atomic Power Lab or for General Electric. And they go around, and over the years, I've been interviewed a couple times for people I know who put me down as references, ha, ha, ha. A government investigator will come to your house and ask you questions about them, and you'll say they're nice people. Have you ever heard them say anything against the United States? No, I haven't. What kinds of background checks are they doing?
Well, when you guys were just talking about all of the finger pointing, the possibilities here, you're talking about having had problems in the Army or in the Navy, and having anger management problems, and having weapons violations problems. Mm-hmm. That is one and one equaling two. I just think when you said before, that we don't know whether any of the things we're fighting for, like I am, fighting for background checks on people. It may not have gotten this guy, but it will get some. And one body saved, one grieving family is well worth doing this. And yet every time anybody mentions this out loud, in comes the gun people and really raises hell.
Mike's point is also good because there are, again, because the questions are illustrating what exactly went into this background check. The latest firm to hire him said they found no evidence of misbehavior in the military that you mentioned, Joe. They found no violations. So
he was not dishonorably discharged.
Exactly.
He was discharged.
Exactly. So what sorts of checks go on? And don't forget, this is the second subcontractor that has gotten into trouble lately. There's also Edward Snowden worked under the same circumstances.
But the Seattle incident, he lived in the Seattle area a couple of years ago, and he shot out the tires of some construction workers. It seemed like he was angry at them for making noise. At least that's what they told police. And
he was irritated, and he went out and he shot out the three of the four tires.
I would point out that Seattle has one of the best investigative news teams in the country. They found that out. Did the government find it out?
And that's a good point.
And he had a permit to carry. Is that right? Concealed weapon.
I don't think he even needed one.
Well, no, that was being reported yesterday, widely reported. I don't know if it's still.
Yeah,
holding
I saw that
up,
too. Saw that too.
Well, I mean, it just shows the complexity. If there's going to be these aberrations and these personality disorders that it can't be tracked, how I guess that's sort of a reality. And with the easy availability of firearms, it's a dangerous combination. But add in the added ability to pass through security at a government high security location, and you really have a problem.
Yeah. One of the things I had a question about that last night, of knowing that area a little bit, in D.C. Seven of the victims were named last night, and I think some more names are coming out this morning. And it was said that all of the victims were believed to be civilians, and no active duty military personnel were killed. That area is a mix. I mean, that's where the Washington Nationals Park is. So that area is a mix of government and commercial enterprise. The police say that he was shooting down from above the people, which is where most of the damage was allegedly done. So I guess my question is, how much of these people, and I guess we don't know this quite yet, of what their involvement was in that particular, of how random it was?
How random, yeah. What they was aiming at anybody, we don't know that.
Or anyone in particular, or from one particular group or unit. What brought them to that place?
I thought it was pretty sad that we were thinking yesterday, oh, thank God it isn't terrorism. It's only a disgruntled employee shooting up the place.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I guess the undercurrent there was that had it been somebody who had hostility towards the U.S. and was from a foreign country, or might have been of a particular ethnic background, it would have immediately branded everybody with that background as being responsible, and that's always problematic. That it was somebody who was a Navy veteran who grew up in Queens and lived around the country, went to a Buddhist temple where he lived in Texas prior to moving to the Washington area, makes him one of us who went off the deep end and committed this horrific act. I don't know what comfort there is in that, but apparently there is.
I know.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about this story and move on to other issues of the day. We welcome your thoughts. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from SUNY New Paltz, offering bachelor degree programs in engineering, business, fine and performing arts, education, and liberal arts. Open house on Saturday, October 26th from 10 to 2. newpaltz.edu/admissions for registration. Union Institute and University, Brattleboro, Vermont, offering a doctorate in psychology with a concentration in clinical psychology. myunion.edu for applications. Carey Institute for Ecosystem Studies, Millbrook, New York, presenting marine scientist Samantha Joy, discussing the BP oil spill, including recovery efforts, October 18th at 7 p.m., careyinstitute.org. And the Olana Partnership, presenting Framing the Viewshed, Groundswell, featuring site-specific works in sound, text, installation, and movement, September 22nd, 2 p.m. to 6 p.m., olana.org.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm Joe Donahue along with Alan Chartok, Mike Spain, and Rosemary Armeo. We welcome you to join the fray as well. Roundtable at WAMC.org. We're talking about the shooting in Washington, D.C., the gunman and 12 victims killed in the shooting at the D.C. Navy Yard yesterday. The investigation continues this morning. There are still many people who are injured, some critically, and we'll obviously be watching their condition over the next several hours and days. I guess before we move on to some other issues and some other questions, I ask this group of non-cynical journalists.
Where are they?
Who's that? Yeah.
Is there such a thing? That are we at a point where it does it seem as though this is just becoming almost sadly routine? You know, that we hear these stories much more than we used to, or is that not? I have no evidence to back this up. I'm just asking the question. It just seems as though it becomes every couple weeks or months we deal with a situation, be it at a school or at a mall or at a place
there is
of employment.
A template. You know, news media sort of has routines and they have templates for covering, you know, the big fire story or the big government story. And I think the national news media has a template for covering these kinds of stories.
Mm-hmm. Do you have a template? I mean, if something happened at, say, God forbid, Crossgates.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have a template?
Well, immediately you begin to try to answer all the questions. Certainly you want to tell what happened and tell, the status of people who were injured or worse. And then you start to do what we're doing here. We try to analyze what the motive is, what could have been done, what signs could have been noticed that were not noticed that let this person do this terrible deed. I mean, it becomes analytical very quickly, and then you look at the political implications. You're already bracing for the NRA to object when people say, see, we need background checks. You know.
Right.
I mean, it's almost like the scenario is already playing out, and there's still many people who are critically injured. There's people who we don't even know of who were killed yesterday. The Washington Post called this the most traumatic event in Washington, D.C. since 9/11 when the Pentagon, was partly destroyed by an airplane crash by terrorists. I mean, it's you try to do all those things, but you're right. I mean, we kind of know what to do since Oklahoma City. I mean, it kind of set it up. I mean, it's just something that's become part of the story.
And I'm going back a ways, but and Alan certainly knows the story. But you know, when you look at the shooting that took place many years ago on the campus of SUNY Albany, I mean, I assume that
Ralph Tortorici,
yes,
in a classroom,
and with hostages and so forth. That gets you. You then have that experience, right? I mean,
right.
Unfortunately, once you go through that, then you're ready for, and then, of course, Simon's Rock and all other horrible stories that have taken place just in our area.
Right. I mean, we remember them. We remember details. They make a mark on us. But after a while, the sadness is that there is a commonality, a routine.
Sure. I mentioned Wayne Lowe, who was the shooter at Simon's Rock, the student, the other day to somebody, an adult, and no idea. You know who this was.
I would point that out to those people who say we glamorize people who do these kinds of shootings and they don't even want their names in the paper. People don't remember. They don't remember names. They remember the events, but I don't think we really glorify them in the news media when you report who they are and what they've done.
Yeah, also there's a sort of, I hate to say this, but I mean, after Newtown and those children killed, you sort of have a terrible, I mean, to me, the idea that I was one of the families that heard in Washington yesterday that a loved one had been killed is more than I think I could bear.
I don't know how you get news like that, how process news like that. It's just so horrific.
Yeah. Facebook and the social media was really very interesting and wonderful yesterday as friends were letting others know, hey, Brian's okay. He's in lockdown at the Coast Guard Center just a few miles away. He's okay. And they were like,
although on NPR yesterday, they had one story that was really interesting. There was a woman who was crying, and she said, "I came to just find him. she didn't say who the him was, and take him, smother him with kisses and take him home. Mm-hmm. And they never told you whether she found him or not.
Wow.
So and I'm sitting there saying, whoa, but what happened? I want that story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It is, I think when you hear a story like this, you obviously try to process, I mean, there's a grief that we all feel, of course, that of a societal ill that causes this type of event to occur. But then you also internalize, or I think many of us do, where you say, oh my God, put yourself in that position of, you know, what is it like to be in that, not only the poor person who's on their way to work or going from one building to another, but to the families and the loved ones who are left with the carnage. And especially when you have the suspect killed, and a lot of questions will never be answered.
Right.
Yeah, it's always horrible when that happens, because you really want.
You really, there's a need for an explanation to try to put it into context, and there's when it happens this way, it leaves everybody guessing.
I mean, you Alan mentioned Newtown, but I mean, will we ever be able to figure out what brought out an armed man into a kindergarten class of all places, and shoot innocent children? I mean,
well, there was one common denominator so far that came out, and that is that he played this suspect, or this shooter, no longer a suspect, Aaron Alexis in Washington D.C. played a lot of violent video games. Some of his friends said that they joked with him about it, and Lanza in Newtown was also somebody who played a lot of violent video games. And yet, millions of kids play violent video games.
Well,
they go out and play, they go off to college, and they grow up and be productive citizens, and it's not...
And they start billion-dollar corporations produce violent video
games.
Well,
Rosemary, do you have a problem with this discussion, because you're making faces?
No, I'm not. I'm listening to it, gritting my teeth, because I have three sons who love video games.
And
it's been an issue of whether to censor them since they were, teenagers. Now they're out of my hands. But even when they were teenagers, my nephew still loves them. And so far as I know, they haven't... committed any major crime, so
I don't think it's a causal effect.
You know what's interesting, Mike, is that one of the effects of the gun lobby is that research into the actual connections between violent games and shooting is unknown, because they've simply stopped research. To me, that's one of the worst things that the NRA has done.
The lobbies have blocked government spending on research and keeping statistics, et cetera, et cetera, and that is a tragedy.
Right. I mean, I would like to be able to say, oh no, Mike, you're totally wrong, or yeah, that's exactly right, but
it's
don't really know,
isn't it?
Yeah, it's all anecdotal, and that's just ridiculous when we are having incidences like this frequently, or I don't know whether it's increasing, but certainly enough that we're talking about it.
Because my baseline, my gut reaction is to say, well, there are going to be people who are affected by those games. There are going to be people who aren't affected by those games, and there's always, if not that, it'll be something else. But my God, and then you see the games. And then I completely change my view. They're horrible.
Yeah,
I mean, it's hard for me to defend them then when you watch them and see what's taking place.
Okay, then you can take the next step. There's violent movies. There's violent TV.
Yes, but you're not the person who's perpetrating the violence.
I've played them because, of course, I have been very worried about my kids. And they are awful. And they're also anti-women, which I hate. But they're so creepily over the top that it's really hard to see how anyone could take that as reality.
Well, and you don't win until you're killed.
You're disturbed, right? And we can't run our society for the disturbed people. This is the same people who say, you can't put a newspaper story that has pornography or graphic details in it because children may say. We don't write newspapers for children. We don't design games, to take care of all the depraved people in our society. The idea is we've got to find the depraved people and help them first.
I'm not so sure I agree with you.
I
think that I saw a story yesterday or the other day that said one game or something like that. I'm probably making some of this up, but one game had grossed over $1 billion.
Oh yeah, they're a huge business.
$1 billion.
Let's take a break. We'll come back and talk about this and much more. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. It's all next on the Roundtable. Good morning. Welcome back to our roundtable panel. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Dr. Alan Chartok is here, Rosemary Armeo, and Mike Spain. And again, we welcome your comments. We've got several letters. Want to read a few of them, beginning with Chuck, who says, I don't believe that there is a way to find direct casual connections between violent video games and this type of tragedy. But I do believe there is a link between our quote-unquote culture of violence, i.e. gaming, movies, and actual wars, constantly being fought. We have become numb to violence, and there is a disconnect to what actually happens when someone is shot and maimed or killed.
Absolutely.
Yeah, reasonable point.
Also, Scott writes, good discussion this morning. I think it would be remiss to talk about violent video games and not mention the violence and misogyny in most rap music. I would submit a high correlation between lower socioeconomic status, urban populations, violence, and rap music. The fantasy that most rap music portrays is dealing drugs to get rich and ruthlessly taking down one's opposition while treating women as objects. Not all rap is like this, but I have been
good
listening
point.
To
Not
it since the
1980s, like
and it is a very high percentage. Another point. And then we get this from Jill, who says, last night a correspondent on one of the cable news channels claimed that he was told that the shooter brought the handgun for which he had a permit into the building with him. The other two guns he got off individuals already inside that he had just shot. Have you heard anything like this, or was this too erroneous information? I heard the same report, and I don't know. I don't know that we know what actually was the use of the guns, the number of firearms that were that were used. So I think that's one of those question marks that is out there that we mentioned before. And Roberta points out that when the FBI asks neighbors questions, they're looking for red flags. Does this person have live high on the hog, way above his income level? Has the neighbor heard loud arguments or witnessed physical violence? A responsible person would just say, oh, he's a good guy.
Wait, I don't get that. You know, in other words, if somebody knew it, a responsible person would just respond to the FBI agent and say, oh, he's a good guy?
I think what they're saying is, I don't know, but it seems to me that we tend to say, oh, I mean, the stereotype is he was a quiet man.
Well, they interviewed people in Texas today, and they were interviewing people who knew him from the Buddhist temple
A Buddhist temple.
Right. And they were saying he's like one of my family. They just were in disbelief about it. You know, I mean, it just goes to show you. Well, I mean, when your name is submitted for a background check interview, usually it's somebody who you believe will be favorable to you.
Yes.
And you won't give them the
well,
neighbor
well,
that
the
you're having
check.
A dispute
yeah,
with.
Yeah, the government checks look all around. But I think the point of our listener is what we were saying, that how good are these background checks? And she's saying
the
questions
are
very, very vague. Then you're going to give them a benefit of doubt. They lives high in the hog. Well, you know, who am I to judge?
Yeah, how do you determine that?
Yeah.
All I can tell you is that my mother ran the Fire Island Youth Group. And
obviously she's suspect.
Yes, and in the winter, you know, there are a few human beings out there, a lot of dogs and cats. Okay, so one day she gets a call from an FBI agent, who says, "Lady, I'm out here with 15 dogs and a lot of cats. It's in December on Fire Island doing a background check on one of your counselors." So, don't you think that's a funny story?
Yeah, that is a funny story.
Oh, so the agent might have known something about.
To look for on Fire.
Well, it's not a perfect process. I think we all agree.
Thank you, Mike. Let us let's move on to stories from the Times Union. Very interesting story about Big Blue, IBM.
Yeah, Larry Rulison, our business and technology writer, follows up a story that he reported last week about the newly established SUNY College of Nanoscience and Engineering in Albany. You know, that's the new offshoot up on Washington Avenue Extension. They're in a program to develop at some high price, large computer chip manufacturing sites near Utica. And it could mean as much as a $45 billion high-tech investment in the Mohawk Valley if everything works out. Now, the plan to invest all this state money, that part of that would be state money, would be, you know, in the Mohawk Valley, has people down in the Hudson Valley concerned, specifically Ron Hicks, who's the Dutchess County Deputy Commissioner for Strategic Planning. He says he's disappointed to hear that. And that's because in East Fishkill in Dutchess County, IBM really is credited with saving the semiconductor industry in New York State back in 2002. And they kind of set the stage for this SUNY College of Nanoscience and Engineering to be established. And that's when they built a $2.5 billion, what was then a state-of-the-art computer chip factory. But, of course, now it's been supplanted by future. So, you know, as the state is investing around New York to try to, you know, grow the economy, it's going to leave some others high and dry.
In other words, are we robbing Peter to pay Paul?
We're robbing Dutchess County to pay Oneida County, I guess.
Right. But I don't understand. So if you lay off 600 workers.
Yeah, IBM has had just done that, right? And that's one of the reasons they're so concerned.
Right. So you lay off 600 workers, and then you open this facility to the north. Wouldn't those workers
migrate
and be included in that?
Well, I mean, the facility that opened in Saratoga County, which, you know, Global Foundries and the one that they're talking about building are not owned by IBM, but you think if they were specialty jobs that they would be prime candidates for the jobs in these new chip manufacturing facilities. But they're reaching across the country, across the globe, actually, to fill specific jobs in these facilities.
Well, there are a whole other bunch of things that are involved in this. One of them is that the governor comes along and he says, we're going to give tax breaks to everybody who comes and works in a SUNY-related business. And obviously, the same principle applies, that you might be getting people who would set up their businesses there who would not set up their businesses somewhere else. That's a possibility, right?
Of course.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then also there's this question. Didn't we read something in your very good paper, Mike, about one of the community colleges out in the Utica area getting asked to join with nanotech, the Scott College of Nanoscience, and after making the argument that they should be separated after SUNY and Albany actually, you know, made them what they are today and got them going. So I'm a little concerned about that one.
Well, what they're trying to do, I mean, the previous story that Larry Rulison wrote last, I think it was in Friday's paper, Times Union, was about that, about, you know, trying to have the impact of the Nanoscience College not simply in Albany or the Capital Region, but to spread it across upstate New York and have a presence across the state. And there could be chip plants and other technology innovations in the Rochester area, which also could benefit from it, even Buffalo that was mentioned. You know, so it's a... It's a new approach, controversial certainly, and it does involve, you know, taking funds that would have benefited one area and investing them elsewhere. Mm. But many would argue, Alan, that the government investment in southern Saratoga County did create a lot of jobs and really did impact the economy. Now a second plant is on track, and that's going to be even bigger, and that will create more jobs. And, you know,
but of course in Austin.
Yes.
They're singing the blues.
Right,
because we brought them here, and this...
Semitech, right. The consortium of chip manufacturing companies was based in Austin, Texas, and now it's...
Beautiful little town.
Yeah, and they credit their growth since the 1980s when Semitech located there to their technology industry, and we've kind of taken some of that away. And this is what Dutchess County is worried about. I mean, IBM had an enormous presence historically in the Mid-Hudson Valley, and now they're cutting back. And part of the story today is that IBM is one of the partners in a semiconductor plant that's being developed in India, although a spokesman for Big Blue says, not to worry, we're just doing training, and we've done that elsewhere in the world. But there's even talk that IBM might be sold or might be taken over by some other company. So it had been the number one employer in Dutchess, Ulster, Westchester County, you know, down through the Mid-Hudson Valley. And I can see why they're concerned. It's a change.
Me too.
I have to – I just want to read in Larry's article two paragraphs – three – about and just the numbers that are included here. The Nano College says the SUNY IT site is ideal for members of its Global 450 Consortium, or G45C, amongst friends, a group that includes IBM, GlobalFoundries, Intel, and others focused on developing the next generation of chip manufacturing at the school. The five-year, $4.8 billion program is working on getting the industry and its suppliers ready for making chips on 18-inch or 450-millimeter silicon wafers. Today's factories, including the IBM East Fishkill fab, use 300-millimeter wafers. That was so yesterday.
It is.
Which are about 12 inches across. Please don't bother me. Officials in Dutchess County are worried that they will lose out on the 450-millimeter transition. However, as part of the G450C agreement with the state, which is footing $400 million of the consortium's bill, IBM is committed to creating 950 new jobs at its semiconductor operations in East Fishkill at New Yorktown Heights, the site of its main R&D center. And IBM's financial commitment under G450C is $3.6 billion, more than all of the other participants combined. So to make the point that they are a very, very large player in this, meanwhile, you know, you wonder if... a large player and yet still feeling snubbed.
Yeah, I mean, they are, I think, everyone would credit IBM as kind of kickstarting the semiconductor industry for New York State, and that the state is trying to spread it across New York to help economically depressed areas, I think is worthy, and it's desperately needed in areas like Utica, Rochester, and Syracuse, and Buffalo, et cetera, that has seen a flight of traditional manufacturing, but Dutchess County was, you know, was the home of IBM since the 60s, the early 60s.
So your point is?
Well, you know, I mean, it's my point is that it's a good thing that we're trying to help the state taxpayers' money is trying to help these depressed areas. Dutchess County should legitimately do everything they can to keep IBM viable in their county, and I can see why that the county planner is concerned.
I think Dutchess County officials must feel a lot like you Albany officials. Like, what did I get out of this
partnership? We made something great. Now it's going to help somebody else. And why don't we benefit from it?
You know who's been outspoken on that issue is our own Karen Hitchcock.
Right.
Who has done she's a gutsy lady.
Mm-hmm. Former UAlbany president. She wrote in the Business Journal a really interesting article.
A terrific article. And right here she did it on our air.
And her point?
Well, no, her point really is that UAlbany deserve better.
Oh, right.
Because, you know, they're the ones who really put all of this together. And just because it's convenient for some guy.
It's more than just loyalty and thankfulness. I mean, business is a cutthroat world, so IBM founded it, yes, gets lots of credit, and indeed does get lots of credit, but what else do they deserve? They're not creating jobs now or enough jobs, so move on. But the idea of disconnecting from UAlbany or from SUNY worries me because it's disconnecting advances in business with knowledge. You know, that whole unity of knowledge, which is the idea of a great university, has been interrupted by this.
Mm. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, we'll finish up with a story about art fraud. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.
Support for WAMC comes from the Bardavon, presenting Diana Krall October 13th, Merle Haggard November 3rd, the Hungarian State Folk Ensemble November 8th, and Vince Gill November 15th. Bardavon.org. Boston Lake Pottery, Boston Lake, New York, offering handmade porcelain pottery, vases, table lamps, place settings, and more since 1975. Wedding registry available, bostonlakepottery.com. Capital Cities Imported Cars, Glenmont, New York, offering new and pre-owned BMWs and Volkswagens, serving the WAMC listening area since 1975. CapitalCitiesVW.com. And Cafe Capriccio, Chef Jim Rua, working to preserve and maintain the traditions of Italian cuisine and hospitality since 1982 on Grand Street in Albany, New York. CafeCapriccio.com.
Welcome back to our roundtable panel. I'm telling you, we ought to offer bonus footage. the breaks. We welcome your comments. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. So the Long Island dealer at the center of an $80 million art forgery scheme that duped dozens of experts and buyers pleaded guilty on Monday to charges of wire fraud, money laundering, and tax evasion. Yikes.
I love it.
Glafira Rosales is the only person who has been indicted in connection with the fraud, which passed off fake paintings as the work of modernist masters, but she is cooperating with federal prosecutors who have said that they expect further arrest. What has particularly fascinated the art world is the scores of paintings and drawings successfully presented as newly discovered works by some of the 20th century's greatest artists were actually produced by a single man and an immigrant from China who painted out of his home and a garage in Woodhaven, Queens.
I want to say that we talked earlier about templates for a story. This story has been written. I was reading it yesterday. I said, I already know this story. It is a book by UAlbany journalism professor Elaine Salisbury called Providence, and it's about an art fraud. It's exactly this story. It happened at another
life
time.
Imitating
but
art, right?
She said, it keeps going on. It keeps happening. No. And the two most interesting things, of course, are the Chinese guy who was painting these modernist masterpieces.
And getting nothing.
Getting nothing, but getting away with it. He's that
right.
good. And the idea that a gallery that's like 165 years old, I believe, a really reputable
firm is out of business,
is out of business because they back it. They
well, just remember the name, Pei Shin Quan. That's the 73-year-old Chinese immigrant living down in Queens and painting up these masterpieces
this
in
stuff
his garage.
May get worth a lot. You know, I knew a guy, you're absolutely right, a fellow who ran the Pearls Art Gallery in New York City. And he was brought down to Texas to look at this guy's collection, this billionaire's collection. And he had a little bit of an accent, and he came in, and he looked at each of those. Fraud, 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 fraud. Can you imagine what that guy was going to faint, thinking about this? Unbelievable.
Wasn't Charles Boyer in some movie where he was painting these?
Yes.
I don't remember what the movie was.
Yes.
Well, my question is, and I don't know if it was 100% clear, but the guy in Queens is painting these. Was he actually the one who was falsely signing the signature and giving them
he signed the signature, which was part of his the beautiful work that he was
doing. I were his attorney, I'd argue he was inspired by the entire painting of the master, including the signature.
Hey, Michael, you can go to any museum in the world. You see the art students sitting there in front of the pictures.
Copying
them. And I'm assuming they copy the name also.
I'm really glad I don't have millions of dollars to spend on art. I would just hate to be taken in this way. It's so easy.
It would be so offensive to have my millions go
to have them wasted that way.
I tell you, watch this guy. His art is going to be worth money.
I agree with you, Mike. I agree with you. You know, I'm married to an artist, a collage artist, and she wants to sell her stuff for less than I think, and I keep saying, come on now, you'll be dead for 100 years and your stuff will be selling for $1 million.
Get it now.
Don't sell anything.
Well, the whole story
make your ancestors rich.
Your great grandchildren. It reminded me of the story last week that a new Van Gogh was found hidden away in an attic.
Right.
Gah.
And is it really Van Gogh? Do we even know now? It was the Chinese guy.
And think of how many stories we hear about. I was at the flea market and I picked up the painting and it was a picture of three
Antique
relatives
Roadshow.
And then all of a sudden I peeled it back and there's, Grandma Moses or
right.
whatever.
Right, exactly. You bought it just for the frame.
Right. And then suddenly I have a $3 million painting. It brings all of those questions.
They're probably sitting in garages and attics around the Capital Region in Western Massachusetts by Norman Rockwell. And, will be the story that's the template we'll use.
It just goes to say, for art, you just buy what you love and forget all this thing about value. You just can't count on it.
Well, I don't know. When I was a kid, I went out with a girl who's father.
I don't know where this story's going.
I know, he knew that.
His father had the two things I remember about this guy is he drove an Austin Healey, and on the main wall of the living room was a gigantic Jackson Pollock.
Wow. You don't really know that. It could have been done by a little
Chinese
guy.
He was a
Jerry Palucci. He lived in Queens. He was his understudy.
He was the ex-friend of Jackson's.
Anybody can splatter that pain, for God's sakes. We'd love to hear from you. Roundtable at WAMC.org. Roundtable at WAMC.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Chartok, thank you all so much. We'll see you very soon.
Okay.
Thank you. You're listening to the Roundtable on WAMC.